Dr. Christopher A. Parsons is currently the Managing Director of the Telecom Transparency Project and a postdoctoral fellow at the Citizen Lab in the Monk School of Global Affairs with the University of Toronto. Dr. Parsons' research focuses on the rationales, processes, practices, and politics of third-party access to telecommunications data. Dr. Parsons, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
I'd like to begin by asking you a few questions pertaining to cybersecurity. Dr. Parsons, how is privacy affected by digitally mediated surveillance? In addition, your research focuses on the normative implications that surveillance has on the contemporary Western political system. Please discuss the significance of some of your research and findings.
So, I mean, we live in an era where more and more of what we do is digitized and sent to the internet, one way or another. And so when I'm talking about digitally mediated surveillance, I'm talking about the processes and practices and tools and even the people that are involved in analyzing that data traffic after you've created it and sent it somewhere. So how does it implicate with privacy? Well, in almost every way you can think of. So you can just think of your email. Someone is processing your email, and other people are often acting on your email. One of the best known examples in recent time, of course, is say you were a member of Yahoo. So we know that the Yahoo email service is widely used, and so Yahoo is processing that data. So there's privacy implications for advertising and things like that. But in addition to that, we know that the National Security Agency, because Yahoo for a long time was not encrypting any of the traffic that your email is going to or your contact books or things like that, was also collecting all of that data, analyzing it, running queries, and often targeting people based on that data. So what are the privacy implications? They're vast. It's often very challenging for regular citizens, to say nothing of experts actually, to fully understand the ramifications of any particular service. And it's made more challenging based on the fact that this is an economy or an area of the economy, that is digital services, that are often poorly or underregulated. And by that I mean, you know, Yahoo is likely going to be around for a long time. Google presumably will be around for a long time and so forth. But what do you do with all the small companies, all the startups? You're providing huge volumes of data to them. And even if there's an intermediary working on that data now, which is sometimes surprising, what happens when that company goes out of business? And so then your data is sold, monetized as part of the bankruptcy proceeding. So figuring out the full ramifications of the privacy implications is very challenging. In terms of the implications it has for Western democracies at a normative level, we're still trying to figure that out, in all honesty. I would say that probably in the mid-90s to, say, early 2000s, there was a whole lot of optimism. There was then a brief period of absolute pessimism. And now we're getting into a point in the academic literature of, oh, my God, what are we looking at and what is this? Which is, you know, probably a more robust, mature discussion to be having. Digital systems and digital tools can be used for incredible benefit. And we've seen this time and time and time again. You know, you can go through and you can look at revolutions around the world that are facilitated by mobile technologies. You can look at the revelation of government secrets that help citizens understand what their governments are doing and so on and so forth. But you can also, by the same light, look at how, you know, the Iranian Green Revolution is a good example, where mobile technologies facilitated or enhanced existing processes on the ground. But all that text message data, all that digital data, turned into evidence, turned into something that the regime could then access and use to harass or target those who are involved in organizing. So it cuts both ways there. At the same time, just as digital systems can reveal secrets, the same global surveillance infrastructures can be used to monitor and then suppress secrets as well. So we're now getting to a point, I think, where we're really appreciating that the internet is, and internet-based services are more and more regionalized, in the sense that national laws are applying different constructs to how telecommunication services are used. And I mean, when it comes to cybersecurity and cyber espionage and all the other cybers, we're watching politicians still struggling to figure out what's going on. And quite often, the people providing the policy expertise or the policy advice are a little bit further ahead than they are, but I would suggest that they don't know exactly how digitally mediated surveillance fully impacts privacy or how either of those fully impact the contours of democratic states.
In terms of laws and regulations, what should be implemented in order to improve cyber security today?
I think that probably one of the most important things to do is avoid rushing into laws. And so when there's a serious act of espionage or there's an attack on a corporation or something like that, rushing with like gut, we need to do something sorts of laws are probably not the way to do it. We keep seeing legislation come up that the way to stop cyber espionage or enhance cybersecurity is to increase the free flow of citizens' information between the corporate sector and government and vice versa and throughout government. I am not convinced that that will necessarily improve things. And for this reason, even were it, I don't think it would, but even were it to make systems more resilient, it would have the simultaneous impact of hindering individuals in knowing how, when, and to whom their information is collected and shared with, and under what conditions. And so all of a sudden, that can create a chilling effect. But it's also the case that when we look at information sharing laws, there is not sufficient good empirical study showing that it's needed. And when it comes to government, there are very good reasons why countries such as Canada, decades ago, passed the Privacy Act. The Privacy Act was meant to ensure that government agencies didn't share information willy-nilly because, unlike a private citizen, governments have incredible power over our lives. And so I think that figuring out ways of siloing information is actually important. Reducing interoperability between government systems can actually be helpful because it means if one particular information silo is compromised, they're not all simultaneously compromised, which strikes me as important. Now, what positive laws could be done? We've seen laws in various jurisdictions. Most recently, there's a bill going through the United States that just passed the Senate in the past couple days, actually, where security researchers are being inhibited from doing their work. So there's either criminal penalties for engaging in research or there's a prospect of civil liability for engaging in research, and not research with the intent of then compromising a target. So not like you find a vulnerability in Java and so you want to exploit it, but rather you want to report it. Now the computer industry, software industry, has gotten better over the past three decades, in dealing with researchers who come forward with vulnerabilities. And that involves, some companies taking the issue very seriously, trying to patch it, sometimes providing some sort of reward to whoever found the vulnerability. And, I mean, this is not trivial work. I mean, these are serious people doing serious work. So some remuneration is likely deserved. But I think at the very least we need to see legislation that tries to establish a barrier around which, academic researchers, white hat hackers, can do that work, report it responsibly without fear of civil or criminal liability. If we do not do that, it does not mean that those white hat hackers, those academics, stop doing their work. It doesn't. It's sort of like, if you make paintings illegal, or the act of painting illegal, painters don't go away. They just don't put their work on display. They don't share it. They don't enrich our culture. Similarly, if we prevent white hat hackers and academics from sharing their research, from improving the security situation that we're in, they don't stop playing. It's what they do. But no one else knows what's going on, and so we're all less secure as a result. So that would be the one kind of law that I think is most needed right now.
In terms of the Privacy Act, do you see any weaknesses associated with this act? And are there, which there are obviously many, but what are a few of the changes that you would suggest be implemented as soon as possible.
Yeah, so the Privacy Act is a terrific piece of legislation that's 2 or 3 decades old, and it's been hollowed and needled, and it's just not suited for the task. I mean, you know, when the drafters were putting it together, they really were not thinking of the internet, let alone Facebook, let alone the Internet of Things. So the Privacy Act in Canada applies to the way the federal government can gain access to and use personal information. There's some components of it that are very good. So as an example, federal departments cannot collect your information without first having a demonstrated need to collect it, so they can't just harvest at will, which is a very positive aspect. But the Privacy Act does not include political parties. So there's no privacy legislation in this country that applies to political parties, period. And perhaps the most damning aspect of that piece of legislation is even if we were to keep it as sort of holy as it is, the one thing that is desperately needed is when the Privacy Commissioner of Canada comes in and does an investigation because some government agency has done something they're not supposed to do, they can't do anything. They just show up and say, this was done, it's in violation of the Privacy Act, and they walk away. They have no ability to...
Do they even complete a report, anything?
There will typically be a report of some sort.
But there's no action.
It's totally based on moral suasion. And so they can't go to courts. There's no mechanism to force change. And so quite often, you know, when these reports are done, the agency is responsible. Do you make improvements? So I don't want to make it sound as though the Privacy Commissioner comes in, nothing happens. But there's no requirement to, other than public pressure. And so if you get into this situation where, and this has happened, where the RCMP or CBSA or other security agencies receive, if you will, a failing grade from the Privacy Commissioner of Canada, there's no requirement to fix and update and change. The other thing that the Privacy Commissioner of Canada does is they review privacy impact assessments. And so these are performed by federal agencies, or supposed to be performed, rather, by federal agencies before they go about collecting information, before they deploy a program that could affect the privacy of Canadians. So the Privacy Commissioner of Canada receives these, or is supposed to receive them. They then review them, and they provide commentary. But they do not have the ability, permission, or powers to do anything more than suggest how a program should be modified. And so that means that if a program is presented to the Privacy Commissioner's office and they go through it and they say, we are deeply concerned, or something of that language, quite often indicating that they think it is in contravention of the law without saying so, there's no requirement to change that process. And so we have these tools that are in place, but they are not sufficient to ensure that decisions are implemented. And I think that most Canadians, I suspect actually most people who look at privacy legislation, are either not surprised because they're very cynical, or when I speak with regular Canadians, they're shocked that we have this independent commissioner, this body that's supposed to hold the government to account in some fashion, and other than wagging his finger, the current commissioner can't do a whole lot.
So pretty much nothing is done. The Act itself does do, there are benefits associated with the Act, however, in terms of taking action, it's limited in a way.
I mean, there are other difficulties with that Act. I mean, there's the Privacy Commissioner's remit is only in the area of personal information. And so if a government agency is conducting a program that negatively affects the privacy of Canadians but is not collecting the personal information of Canadians, then you know their ability to investigate is significantly weakened. And so as an example, you could look at, say, a surveillance operation run by any number of government agencies that could have an impact on how Canadians behave because there's a degree of surveillance entailed in it. But if that surveillance does not explicitly include the hoovering up of personal information, or it does so through, you know, a court process or something, the Privacy Commissioner's office's ability to say, look, there's a problem here, it's really limited. And that's the difficulty, as is their general inability to share information with other bodies responsible for overseeing security and intelligence agencies. So as an example, in Canada, we have the CERC, which oversees CSIS, which is our domestic security intelligence service that's recently massively expanded in mandate in the past couple months, as well as the the commissioner that oversees CSE, the Communications Security Establishment, our Foreign Signals Intelligence Agency. And you would think the Privacy Commissioner, CERC, and Commissioner CSE would probably be able to like sit down and chat when they're looking
hopefully
at similar problems. But they're actually not permitted to. And so there's a deliberate firewall in the way that they talk with one another in the most obtrusive ways. Is they read one another's declassified reports and try to read the tea leaves to see if one agency is telling another agency something. And it's worked a few times, but you shouldn't be relying on independent officers of Canada to read tea leaves as opposed to like knock on one another's doors and say, hey, we're looking at this, are you? Let's compare notes.
Right.
And that's a real difficulty because different offices will have different expertise. And this is effectively saying the overseers cannot coordinate, whereas those that they are overseeing have all these new powers to share information and to liaise with one another and so forth, and they can. And so it's a really problematic oversight structure.